Ecclesiastes 6. I have seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on mankind. God gives some people wealth, possessions, and honor, so that they lack nothing their hearts desire. But God does not grant them the ability to enjoy them, and strangers enjoy them instead. This is meaningless, a grievous evil. A man may have 100 children and live many years, yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and does not receive proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. It comes without meaning, it departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it has more rest than does that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but fails to enjoy his prosperity, do not all go to the same place. Everyone's toil is for their mouth, yet their appetite is never satisfied. What advantage have the wise over fools? What do the poor gain by knowing how to conduct themselves before others? Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Whatever exists has already been named, and what humanity is has been named. No one can contend with someone who is stronger. The more the words, the less the meaning, and how does that profit anyone? For who knows what is good for a person in life during the few and meaningless days they pass through like a shadow? Who can tell them what will happen under the sun after they are gone?
Thanks, Rachel, and can I have my welcome? It's lovely to see you here for this last in the series on toil and trouble, work without meaning. And I don't know whether you saw this article in the Evening Standard last night, Productivity and Stress, What Makes London Work So Well? And it's the first of David Cameron's commissioned survey on happiness and wellness. And it says, Londoners are the most stressed and the least satisfied people in England, with those in the inner city suffering more than suburbanites, the first half of Prime Minister David Cameron's happiness index revealed. It says, when asked about their level of satisfaction with life, 27.2% of Londoners ranked it as between 0 and 6 on a 1 to 10 scale, the worst in the country. The most satisfied were in the largely rural southwest. Well, that wasn't very encouraging for me to read, given that I come from Penzance and maybe should have stayed there. But over these last few weeks, we've been examining the whole question of whether we can rely on money and career to give us satisfaction in this life. And we've seen that if we've been looking to our working lives to bring ultimate, lasting satisfaction, we're going to be utterly disappointed, aren't we? We're going to experience futility, frustration, and despair. Last week's Bible reading said that the best we can do in this life is to enjoy our food and drink and our work and not think too much about our mortality. Today's passage calls into question whether even that is enough. The writer of Ecclesiastes is like a particularly brutal paint stripper, isn't he? He strips away layer after layer of things that we might depend on for satisfaction in life, things that we think would make us happy. And so finally, at the end of today's passage, I think he leaves us utterly exposed. It's a painful process, but it's a necessary one, I think. His message would be much more palatable if he just chipped off the flakiest bits of our paintwork and then whacked a new coat over the top. But if you've ever done any decorating, you'll know that that's not a lasting solution. Soon enough, the new coat of paint will start to bubble and start to flake. And pretty much pretty soon we can see that the whole new coat will be flaking off and we'll be back where we started, won't it? Won't we? Now let me just say right up front that there is wonderful hope for the Christian beyond this world. And we can be sure of it because Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And I'm going to be coming on to that at the end of today's talk. But before we will truly appreciate that glorious promise, well, we need to allow Ecclesiastes to strip away anything else that we might rely on, that we might be tempted to depend on, instead of resurrection life. In last week's passage, the closing verses sounded quite positive about the pleasures of this life. Chapter 5, verse 19, you don't have it on your sheet, but it says, "When God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift from God." But any hopes we might have had that that is going to be fully satisfying are quickly dashed at the start of today's reading. Maybe you could have a look at it again on your sheet on the inside page there. It says, "I've seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on mankind. God gives some people wealth, possessions, and honour so that they lack nothing their hearts desire. But God does not grant them the ability to enjoy them, and strangers enjoy them instead. This is meaningless, a grievous evil." The message is this: even having everything isn't enough. Even having everything isn't enough. We might receive all the wealth, possessions and honour we could ask for, but even that is no guarantee that we'll be able to enjoy it. God's people in the Old Testament, the nation of Israel, had this experience of strangers enjoying all their hard-earned pleasures. Foreign invaders plundered their land, and all they could do was sit back and watch, sickened and destroyed. I suppose we might experience something like that, a stranger enjoying the fruits of our labour in other ways. It might be through theft. It might be through loss from mis-selling. Increasingly, actually, it's through broken families, isn't it? There are many men today, sometimes women, but more often men, who are paying large sums of money each month to an ex-wife who is living in the marital home with her children and with her new man. A stranger enjoying wealth, possessions and honour that we've earned. Maybe there are one or two people here today who are in that situation. How gutting, how heart-wrenching to receive all that we desire, only then to see a stranger enjoying the benefits instead of us. Whereas last week we heard of the grievous evil of losing great wealth, here we have a double whammy, don't we? Not only do we lose it, but someone else enjoys it instead. Even having everything isn't enough. What's more, secondly, even a long life isn't enough. I guess if we could choose, maybe we'd like to have our obituary in the Times recording that we lived a long and successful life. But Ecclesiastes tells us that even that isn't enough. Verse 3, "A man may have 100 children and live many years, yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and does not receive proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he." One commentator puts it like this: even before the loss of wealth, and even if a man has sons for heirs, and even if he lives far beyond the human lifespan, his life is wasted if he himself has not known pleasure. And I'm not sure whether Ecclesiastes wants to leave open the possibility of us enjoying prosperity at all. There are so many things that can go wrong. And even then, wealth isn't lasting. Even if we live to 100, we still ultimately face death. And we might receive a proper burial in the sense here, I think, that we're honoured at our death. But even that doesn't last. The church where I'm based has walls that are covered in monuments to long dead people. And when I gave this talk there a couple of weeks ago, I asked them, "Look around at these monuments. Have you ever stopped to read them? Could you name a single person that's commemorated in this building? There must be hundreds of names on the wall. And even if we could name someone that was honoured there, do we really honour them? By the fact they have monuments there, I imagine they must have been very worthy figures of their day, rich and successful and impressive. But what good is that to them now? The writer of Ecclesiastes, our spiritual paint stripper, is utterly brutal in his assessment, isn't he? I wouldn't dare use the shocking image that he does here in verse 3. He says a stillborn child is better off than he. It comes without meaning, it departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it has more rest than does that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but fails to enjoy his prosperity. Have you faced up to this reality? If this life is all there is, we may as well be an unformed, dead fetus. Back in chapter 1, the writer began a search for what might give meaning to life. He tried wisdom. He tried pleasure. He tried work. But he's come to the conclusion that all of them are meaningless. In verses 7 through to 9, he says that everyone's toil is for their mouth, yet their appetite is never satisfied. What advantage have the wise over fools? What do the poor gain by knowing how to conduct themselves before others? Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. You see, our appetites remain unsatisfied. That's what verse 7 says, isn't it? Wisdom doesn't provide the answer, verse 8. The best conclusion the preacher seems able to come to is that our appetites are never satisfied. Not just our bodily appetites, but the bigger hungers that he's been talking about. The hunger for money, for reputation, for satisfying work. It's a bleak picture, isn't it? We must just enjoy being able to look at good things, but it's meaningless to desire more than that. As I've said in previous weeks, it undermines our motivations for work, doesn't it, in a market economy? Far from aspiration, far from ambition to better ourselves and our situation and to enjoy more of the fruits of our economy, well, the writer says those are hopeless dreams. He seems to leave us only with hopeless, cynical, bitter nihilism. He closes this section of Ecclesiastes by saying that despair is the realistic conclusion. The search for meaning seems to be utterly defeated. The writer says he's realised that we can't change the world. Verse 10. Whatever exists has already been named, and what humanity is has been known. No one can contend with someone who is stronger. Any hope that we might have had of making a difference in the world, leaving it a bit better than when we started, leaving a legacy, is ultimately futile. The writer seems to have a bleak view of God, doesn't he? The stronger man who's decided in advance everything that's going to happen so that we can't influence it. It's a depressing thought, isn't it? Not only can we not change the world, but in verse 11, we can't explain the world either. The more the words, the less the meaning. And how does that profit anyone? For all the late night student conversations, for all the works of philosophy, for all the scientific exploration, yes, including the God particle, ultimately we're no closer to finding meaning. In fact, we end up bemused and bewildered, overwhelmed, further off than when we started. And in verse 12, we can't even tell what is good. No one knows what is good for a person in life during the few and meaningless days they pass through like a shadow. For all the provisional conclusions the writer has come to, and he's told us a few things that are good in this world, they're still defeated by the bleak ultimate reality if this life is all there is. I've recently read this book, How to Find Fulfilling Work. It's published by the School of Life. Have you come across the School of Life? It's an organisation set up by a bunch of atheistic philosophers who are trying to tell us how to do life well if there's no God. But you see, the writer of Ecclesiastes is a few thousand years ahead of them, isn't he? There might be some passing wisdom in the book, but if this life is all there is, we're still left with work and with lives that can't ultimately satisfy. Can you see that if this life is all there is, the realistic conclusion is despair? That's the conclusion that scores of thinkers have come to down through the ages. Many of the people who have thought most deeply about these questions have ended up either in madness or in suicide. Most of us, I think, don't push the evidence to its logical conclusion. Something inside us knows that this is the logical conclusion to this life, if this is all there is, and yet we resist it through denial, don't we? Sometimes we medicate for the despair that this life realistically brings. You know, I'm sure, about the rise in prescription drugs for depression and anxiety in our modern age. Metro, a few weeks ago, had this typically measured headline: zombie epidemic, tranquilizer abuse among women soars. It's a ridiculous headline, isn't it? But the story is actually very sobering. Stressed out women are turning in their millions to prescription drugs as they try to escape financial strains and the pressures of family life. They're more likely to abuse tranquilizers prescribed by their doctors than use cannabis or other illegal substances, a UN study found. Others of us do self-medicate with illegal substances or with alcohol. Or we try to find distractions, don't we, through sex and relationships, through career, through travel, or even through religion. It was Karl Marx who described religion as opium for the masses. And frankly, unless our religion is based on a rational conviction about the hope of life after death, well, our religion is just wishful thinking, isn't it? Maybe it's about comforting rituals. Maybe it's about some sort of mysticism. But I'll say it again, unless it's based on hard-headed, reasoned conviction about life after death, it's simply another form of denial and wishful thinking. Hard-hitting stuff this lifetime, isn't it? This is your first week with us. It's not always this gloomy. We're about to come on to the wonderful hope of the Christian message. But before we do that, let's just take a pause and be real with ourselves. What's your outlook? What's your outlook? Have you faced up to the despair, which is the realistic conclusion, if this life is all there is? Or are you in denial? Do you mask the despair through medication of some kind? Do you distract yourself through some futile search? Maybe you've retreated into an apathetic or cynical attitude that just refuses to take anything seriously beyond your next meal. Ecclesiastes has stripped back and back, hasn't it, anything that we might be tempted to rely on for meaning in this life. Are you feeling exposed? Have we got back to bare metal? Let's go on then, shall we, to Christian hope. Because paint stripping is never an end in itself. Ecclesiastes strips away the flaky old paint in preparation for a lasting, satisfying, wonderful new coat. And we find that new coat in the promises of the prophets, and in the way that they're kept in the New Testament. Even in our passage today, we've had hints that life beyond this life would provide the answer the writer is seeking. You see, in verse 6 he writes, "Do not all go to the same place." Verse 12, "Who can tell what will happen under the sun after they're gone?" It's tantalizing, isn't it? Those little clues that if only there was life after death, a reckoning, some form of eternal hope, then the world would make more sense. Life would be worth living. Well, the rest of the Bible claims that there is life beyond death, and that we have firm empirical evidence for it. You'll see the reference on the sheet to Isaiah 65. If you've got your own Bible with you, you might just want to turn it up. Let me read a few verses from it. Isaiah 65, I'm reading from verse 17. God says, "Behold, I will create a new heavens and a new earth. Never again will there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. He who dies at 100 will be thought a mere youth. He who fails to reach 100 will be considered accursed. They will build houses and dwell in them. They will build, plant vineyards and eat their fruit. No longer will they build houses and others live in them, or plant and others eat. For as the days of a tree, so will be the days of my people. My chosen ones will long enjoy the works of their hands. They will not toil in vain or bear children doomed to misfortune. For they will be a people blessed by the Lord, they and their descendants with them." Isn't that a wonderful picture of a reversal of our fortunes? No longer will they build houses and others live in them. Strangers won't enjoy the fruits of our labours. We will. There will be no more stillborn babies. Our work will not be in vain. Ecclesiastes says that if this world is all there is, our appetites are never satisfied. But the rest of the Bible responds by saying, this world isn't all there is. There is a time coming when all our right desires can and will be satisfied. But is this just the sort of wishful thinking that I've been talking about? Is it just opium for the masses? Well, there's one clear reason why we can answer a confident no to that question, and that's because Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And so we can be sure that there is life beyond death. The Bible claims that Jesus rose from the dead bodily in history, and that because he experienced life after death, we can be sure that we can too. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 14. It is printed there on your sheet at the bottom of the outline. It says, "If Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith." Later on, in verse 32, it says, "If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." It echoes Ecclesiastes, doesn't it? The best answer, if this life is all there is to enjoy our food and drink and try to forget about mortality. But the Bible insists that we can be sure that there is a better life to come because Jesus rose from the dead. And so the last verse of 1 Corinthians 15 says this, "Therefore, my dear brothers, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labour in the Lord is not in vain." If this life is all there is, our work is ultimately in vain. The only realistic conclusion is despair. But this life isn't all there is. And that makes our labour in the Lord, our work for God, purposeful and valuable. I think we sometimes think that the promise of life after death is a bit like a get out of jail free card. You know, it's helpful to have ready for when the time comes, but until then I can just get on with living this life. Or more unusually, maybe we can think that because the next life is coming, this life is just to be endured. But do you see that resurrection life means that both of those attitudes are wrong? It gives purpose to what we're doing in this life. First, it frees us to enjoy the relative blessings of this life. It frees us to enjoy the relative blessings of this life. Because this life isn't where my ultimate hope lies, well, I can enjoy the good things of this life without disappointments. You see, they're provisional blessings. It is good if my job goes well, if I'm in a good marriage, if I can enjoy good food and wine. I can enjoy these things precisely because I know that they're not ultimate. You see, if I was relying on those things for ultimate satisfaction, they would only disappoint. They can't bear the weight of my dreams. But because I have a greater hope, well, I can enjoy the blessings of this life for what they are. They're passing pleasures. foretastes, in fact, of the new creation. The resurrection life gives us purpose in another way as well. What does the verse say? Always give yourself fully to the work of the Lord. We have particular purpose in the work of the Lord. I guess that means any work which is done to prepare myself and others for eternity. So a great question might be, how can I use my working life to prepare myself and others for eternity? Is it an opportunity to point others to the eternal hope through my diligent work, my cheerful attitude, my sense of perspective when things go wrong? Is it an opportunity to encourage my Christian brothers and sisters to keep looking to eternity for their hope? I've put that question on your sheet to think hard about afterwards. It's on the back of the handout. I realise that this idea of life after death might be totally new to some people here this lunchtime, and if that's you, it probably sounds a bit weird. Maybe it sounds like exactly the kind of wishful thinking that I was talking about earlier. Well, just notice that Christians' hope for eternal life is based on a conviction about something that happened in history. Jesus Christ bodily rose from the dead himself. And so I'd love you to examine that claim for yourself if you haven't done so. I've brought along three of these little booklets called The Evidence for the Resurrection. And it just goes through, in a few pages, the reasons why we think we can be sure that Jesus Christ rose from the dead in history. And just ask me for one afterwards, if you haven't read something like it or been persuaded already. But as you think about Jesus' resurrection, keep in mind that the only rational alternative is despair. Please don't be satisfied with denial or distraction from the big questions of life. Take a good close look at the evidence. Everything hangs on it.